Welcome to the deep dive. You know, if you've ever driven past a really big crash scene, maybe multiple cars, or seen crews trying to get someone out of, say, a collapsed trench, well, it looks like chaos.
Right, just pure chaos from the outside.
Exactly. But today, we want to take you inside that scene. We're focusing on what are called technical rescue incidents, TRIs, and looking at the very systematic plan that EMS and specialized teams follow, especially when getting someone out of a wrecked vehicle.
Yeah, it's so much more than just, you know, basic first aid on the side of the road. Our goal here is really to show you the kind of hidden checklist, the control that goes into turning what looks like total mayhem into, well, almost a surgical procedure.
A surgical procedure, I like that. So this deep dive, it's for anyone who wants to understand the, frankly, incredible complexity behind pulling off a successful rescue. It's like a map for managing that chaos.
Mm-hmm. And a technical rescue incident, or TRI, it's basically any rescue that's complex. It needs special gear, special skills, stuff that's beyond your standard ambulance crew's everyday kit.
And paramedics, they're often the first ones there, right? So they have to be ready for, well, pretty much anything.
Absolutely. Which is why the training is tiered. You've got to know who can do what safely. Everyone starts at the awareness level.
Okay.
That means you know the dangers, you can spot them, and crucially, you know when to yell for help, basically.
Got it. Call in the specialists.
Then you've got operations level. These folks can actually assist the rescue teams, use some basic tools, support the operation.
Okay. Bit more hands-on.
And finally, the technician level. These are the pros. The ones operating the heavy hydraulic tools, the jaws of life, cutting steel, lifting heavy things. Highly specialized.
What's really interesting, though, is something you mentioned earlier from the sources that for those highly trained technicians, sometimes the most dangerous moment is realizing they're still in that awareness phase on a specific problem.
Exactly. Knowing when to stop, take a breath, and say, nope, this hazard is beyond my current capability. We need to wait for Team X or Tool Y. That pause, that decision to wait, that's a critical life-saving skill in itself.
Patience as a skill. I like that.
Definitely. And whether you're the one waiting or the one cutting, the whole thing follows a very strict sequence. It has to.
Right. Let's lay out those steps. This is the framework for our whole discussion today.
Yeah.
It starts way before any incident with preparation.
Mm-hmm.
Then comes the response.
Mm-hmm.
Then that crucial first few minutes, arrival and scene size up.
Critical.
Next, stabilization of the scene.
Yeah.
Only after all that do we get to access the patient.
Then disentanglement.
Followed by removal and finally transport. It's, a very precise chain.
And that preparation piece, it literally never stops. It means constant joint training, fire departments, police, EMS, specialized rescue teams, all practicing together.
And how the response actually works can be different depending on where you are, right?
Oh, absolutely. Some larger EMS services might have their own in-house TRI teams, fully equipped and trained.
Right.
Others might rely entirely on the local fire department or a regional rescue squad for the heavy technical stuff. So knowing who is coming and what they bring is part of that prep.
But no matter the model, that first call to dispatch information, that's the absolute starting point for the responders, isn't it?
It's everything. Yeah. They're already building a mental picture on the way to the scene. Location, obviously. What kind of incident is it? What's the patient's condition? Where are they positioned? How many people are trapped? Any known injuries? And crucially, what are the specific hazards? Fire, wires down, unstable structure.
And trying to get all that information across clearly and quickly when things are, you know, pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
That's where standard communication protocols come in handy.
Yeah, you can't have people rambling. We use acronyms like you can. It just simplifies things massively for that initial radio report.
You can. Okay, what's that stand for?
It's unit who's reporting. Conditions what you see, briefly. Actions what you're currently doing. And needs what resources you need right now.
Unit, conditions, actions, needs. You can, Pan.
Okay.
Got it. Keeps it focused.
Exactly. No wasted words.
So that initial size up, figuring out the conditions and needs, leads straight to what you call the golden rule of public service.
Your own safety first, always.
I get why that's the rule, obviously.
Yeah.
But how tough is it really for someone trained to help to see an injured person just yards away and resist that powerful urge to just rush in?
It is probably the single hardest thing to drill into people, especially early in their careers. The instinct is overwhelming, but rushing in before the scene is safe, you just become another patient.
Right. You make the problem worse.
Instantly worse. The whole operation grinds to a halt to deal with you. So maintaining that situational awareness, constantly scanning for hazards, knowing where your team is, where other units are moving, assessing the stability of whatever you're dealing with, it's just, It's non-negotiable.
And often, the biggest, most immediate danger isn't even the wreck itself or the collapsed structure. It's everything around it. You mentioned traffic.
Oh, absolutely. Ongoing traffic is probably the most common and honestly the most dangerous secondary hazard responders face day in, day out.
Which is why there's a whole system for managing it.
Exactly. Traffic Incident Management, or TIM, it's a whole discipline in itself. TIM is about systematically controlling that traffic flow, setting up barriers, warning signs, using vehicles correctly, creating a safe work zone.
Because one distracted driver
can destroy everything. Instantly. Even a perfectly managed rescue scene can turn catastrophic because someone wasn't paying attention miles back. So yeah, responders have to be experts in TIM.
Okay, so the first unit arrives. Does that quick you can size up? Then what? Who takes charge?
The first arriving qualified responder automatically assumes incident command, the IC, at least initially. And their immediate priority is stabilization.
And the sources mentioned three basic guidelines for that initial stabilization.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. Approach the scene cautiously. Don't rush in. Position your emergency vehicle, your apparatus, properly. And then start assisting the specialized teams as they arrive or getting ready for them.
Let's dig into that apparatus positioning. Because it sounds like the ambulance or fire truck itself becomes a tool.
It absolutely is. It's your first and maybe biggest piece of safety equipment. You intentionally park these large vehicles to act as a physical barrier, a shield.
Blocking traffic, essentially.
Exactly. Protecting the responders working on the scene from traffic. It creates a shadow or a safe zone. You also have to think about leaving space for the ambulance to load later, usually positioning it slightly uphill or upwind from the immediate hazard, if possible.
Okay. Uphill, upwind makes sense for fluids or fumes. Now, something else mentioned was using only essential warning lights. That sounds a bit weird. Don't you want to be as visible as possible?
You'd think so, right? Yeah. But too many flashing lights, especially at night, can actually be blinding or confusing to approaching drivers. It can create a sort of moth effect or just sensory overload. Okay. So less is sometimes more.
Precisely. Use enough lights to be clearly visible and warn traffic, but not so many that it becomes a confusing, disorienting mess. It's about effective warning, not just maximum flashing.
Once the IC is established, they set up zones, right?
Yeah.
To control who goes where, hot, warm, cold.
Yep. Think of it like concentric circles of safety and control. The hot zone is ground zero. That's where the actual rescue work is happening, the cutting, the lifting, direct patient contact. Only essential personnel with the right protective gear are allowed in, period.
Okay, most dangerous. Then the warm zone.
The warm zone is the buffer area around the hot zone. This is where you'd stage equipment that's about to go in, maybe set up decontamination areas if needed, and support personnel operate. It's the transition space.
And the cold zone.
Cold zone is the outermost perimeter. It's considered safe. That's where you'll find the command post, staging areas for incoming units, maybe the media corral, support personnel. It's the logistics hub.
Now, be honest. In the middle of a chaotic, multi-vehicle pileup, can you really keep those zones perfectly neat and tidy? No. Not perfectly, especially not in the first few frantic minutes. It's dynamic. Things shift. But establishing the concept and the boundaries is crucial for command and control, and especially for safety accountability.
Accountability, right. Knowing who's where.
Absolutely. The IC needs to know who has crossed into that hot zone at all times. Because if something goes wrong, a secondary collapse, a fire, you need to know exactly who is in immediate danger. That structure, even if fluid, saves lives.
Okay, let's zoom in on the vehicles themselves. Basic stabilization is key parking brake, put it in park, turn the engine off. Simple stuff.
Crucial first steps. Neutralize the vehicle as much as possible.
But what about external hazards? Like downed power lines. That seems terrifying.
It is. And the rule there is absolute. If you arrive and see downed lines, or even suspect they might be down near the incident, you stop. Park at least one full telephone pole span away.
One full span? That's quite a distance.
It is, and it's non-negotiable. You do not go near it. The IC's job is to confirm with the utility company that the power is completely shut off before anyone approaches that area. You never, ever touch or try to move a potentially live wire, ever.
That seems straightforward enough. But things get more complicated with newer vehicles, right? Electric cars, hybrids, alternative fuel.
Yeah, alternate powered vehicles or APVs add another layer. With a regular car, you cut the 12-volt battery cable, and most things are pretty much inert.
Okay.
With APVs, you've got high-voltage systems, big battery packs, often running through bright orange cables. The good news is they're designed with safety systems that should shut down the high voltage when the vehicle loses power or is turned off.
Sure.
Well, you can't assume. So trained rescuers need to know how to fully secure that system. Often, the key is still disconnecting the standard 12-volt battery, because that usually controls the relays for the high-voltage system. But you also need to know where the main high voltage disconnects are, and the battery locations themselves aren't always obvious anymore.
Right, they could be under seats, in the trunk.
Exactly. And you also have to watch out for potential chemical leaks from damaged batteries, or in some cases, risks from stored fuels like hydrogen or natural gas. It requires specific knowledge.
So, all this stabilization, securing the scene, dealing with hazards, waiting for power companies or specialized teams, it can take a while. Meanwhile, you've got a patient trapped inside, potentially scared, hurt.
Definitely. And this is something the source has really highlighted that I found quite insightful. That period of waiting, the contact you make with the patient during that time is crucial.
How so?
Just maintaining a calm, reassuring presence, talking to them gently, explaining what's happening, even if it's slow. If possible, maybe patting sharp edges near them. This isn't just bedside manner. It's actually considered a form of non-pharmacologic pain and anxiety control.
So keeping them calm actually helps medically.
Absolutely. When someone's trapped for potentially hours, fear and anxiety can make their physical condition worse. Stress hormones, heart rate, blood pressure. A calm rescuer can actively help manage that while the heavy work gets underway.
Okay, scene stable, hazards controlled, patients being reassured. Now the technicians move in. We need to actually get to the patient.
Yeah.
There's a difference between access and disentanglement, right?
Yeah, it's a really important distinction. Think of it like this. Access is about making an opening, creating just enough space, maybe breaking a window, popping a door to allow a medic to reach the patient and start immediate medical care.
Okay, making a doorway, basically.
Exactly. Simple access might just use hand tools. Complex access might need hydraulic cutters or spreaders just to make that initial hole. But disentanglement, that comes next. That's the process of removing the vehicle from around the patient.
Peeling the car away.
Pretty much. Cutting pillars, removing the roof, pushing the dashboard away, physically creating the space needed to lift the patient out safely without causing more injury.
And you said medical care starts as soon as access is made, even if they're still pinned.
Immediately. As soon as a medic can safely reach the patient, they start. Controlling major bleeding, assessing airway, breathing, circulation, maybe stabilizing the neck if possible. Life-saving care doesn't wait until they're fully out.
Got it. Now, tools. Everyone knows the jaws of life, the hydraulic spreaders, but there's a whole toolbox involved.
Oh yeah, a huge range. The sources break them down into about four main categories of hand tools besides the power tools. You've got striking tools like sledgehammers, used carefully.
Right.
Then leverage, prying, and spreading tools, things like Halligan bars, pry bars, even basic hydraulic spreaders. Cutting tools, hacksaws, reciprocating saws, maybe specialized glass saws.
Okay.
And lifting, pushing, or pulling tools. Jacks, straps, come-alongs, small airbags for lifting.
And you can't just start cutting anywhere on the car, I assume.
Absolutely not.
Right.
That's where knowing vehicle anatomy is critical. Modern cars mostly use unibody construction, meaning the body and frame are one piece. The strength is in specific places.
Like the posts.
Exactly. Rescuers use standardized terms for the roof pillars, the A post by the windshield, B post between the doors, C post by the rear window, maybe a D post on SUVs or wagons. You need to know where these are, what they're made of, sometimes hardened steel, and what happens if you cut them.
And things like the file wall, the bulkhead between the engine and passenger area.
Yep. Knowing that anatomy tells you where you can cut safely and effectively and where cutting might cause the whole structure to collapse inwards onto the patient, it's precise work.
Speaking of precision and danger, airbags. You mentioned them earlier. If they haven't deployed in the crash?
They are a massive hazard. A deployed airbag is safe. It's done its job. An undeployed airbag is essentially a loaded weapon waiting for a trigger.
What kind of trigger?
It could be vibrations from cutting, shifting the vehicle's structure, even sometimes just a delayed reaction or electrical short. And these things deploy with incredible force, hundreds of miles an hour, right where rescuers might be working or where the patient is.
So what's the protocol for undeployed airbags?
Priority one, try to disconnect the power source, usually the 12-volt battery, as we discussed, that should disable them, but again, no guarantees.
Right.
Rescuers are explicitly trained not to cut through a steering wheel if the airbag hasn't deployed. And critically, never place any hard objects like backboards or toolboxes between the patient and an undeployed airbag.
Because it could become a projectile.
Exactly. And just generally, avoid working directly in the potential deployment path if at all possible. It's a constant high stress awareness issue.
Okay, so once access is gained, patients being cared for, hazards managed, the disentanglement really begins. Removing the car from the patient, what are the main techniques?
Well, three common major steps focus on creating space. First, often, is removing the windshield.
Why the windshield?
It does a couple of things. It improves communication visually and verbally between the rescuers outside and the medic inside with the patient. And it's often a necessary first step before you can do the second major technique, removing the roof.
Taking the whole roof off?
Yep. Cutting the A, B, and sometimes C posts allows you to lift the entire roof section off. This gives you maximum space to work around the patient, provide more advanced care, and eventually lift them out vertically, which is often safer for potential spinal injuries.
Okay, that makes sense. And the third big one sounds intense. Displacing the dashboard.
It is intense. This is usually needed when the patient's legs or feet are trapped under the dashboard or by the pedals, often because the front end crumpled significantly.
Right.
It involves a specialized technique sometimes called the dash roll or dash lift. You use hydraulic cutters to make relief cuts in the A posts near the floor. Then you place a powerful hydraulic ram between the B post, or another solid point, and the dashboard area.
And just push it.
You push the entire dashboard assembly upwards and forwards, away from the patient. It literally rolls or lifts the crushing weight off their lower body. It takes incredible precision, coordination, and, again, highly trained technicians. You can't just wing that one.
Now, while car crashes are, unfortunately, common TRIs, technical rescue skills are needed in lots of other places. Let's talk about confined spaces. What exactly makes a space confined in rescue terms?
Good question. It's not just about being small. A confined space is basically any area like a tank, a silo, a vat, a sewer, a trench that's large enough for someone to get into, but it's not designed for people to be in continuously. And it usually has limited ways in or out.
Okay. And the biggest danger isn't necessarily getting stuck.
No. The number one killer in confined spaces is the atmosphere. You have to assume the air inside is IDLH, immediately dangerous to life or health.
Immediately dangerous? Why? What's likely to be in there?
A nasty cocktail, potentially. Lack of oxygen is common.
Yeah.
But also toxic or flammable gases. Things like hydrogen sulfide, H2S, that rotten egg smell from decomposed materials like sewage. Very deadly.
Okay.
Carbon monoxide, CO, from engines or incomplete combustion. Methane, CH4, which is highly flammable, often found in sewers or silos. Others too, like ammonia, carbon dioxide, displacing oxygen, nitrogen oxides. The list goes on.
So you can't just rush in.
Absolutely not. Entering without testing the atmosphere and without a self-contained breathing apparatus, SCBA, is often fatal within minutes. Rescue teams must monitor the air first, ventilate if possible, and wear SCBA. Sometimes entry isn't possible at all until the atmosphere is controlled.
Okay, shifting gears, completely water rescue. What are the immediate concerns when someone's in the water, especially cold water?
Cold water is a huge factor. Two main things happen fast. First, hypothermia. The body loses heat incredibly quickly. If someone is conscious, they need to try and adopt the HELP position, heat escape lessening position.
HELP position.
Yeah, you pull your knees up to your chest, keep your arms close to your sides, basically making yourself into a ball to protect your core and reduce the surface area losing heat.
Makes sense. What's the second risk?
The mammalian diving reflex. Especially in very cold water, sudden immersion, particularly of the face, can trigger an immediate sharp drop in heart rate bradycardia. It's a primitive reflex to conserve oxygen, but it can be so severe it leads to fainting or even cardiac arrest right there in the water.
Wow. Okay. So how do rescuers approach someone in the water? I've heard reach, throw, row, go.
That's the standard safety hierarchy, exactly. Reach. First, try to reach them from shore with something, a pole, a branch, your hand if close enough. Throw. If you can't reach, throw them something that floats, a rope bag, a life jacket, a buoy. Row. If throwing doesn't work, try to use a boat or raft to get to them. Go. Only as the absolute last resort, if you are trained and equipped for water rescue, do you enter the water yourself. Going in is always the highest risk option for the rescuer.
And spinal injuries must be a big concern if someone, say, dove into shallow water.
Huge concern. If there's any suspicion of a head, neck, or back injury, you have to maintain spinal mobilization while they are still in the water. Keep their head and neck stable relative to their body before you even think about pulling them out.
Gotcha. One more special environment. Tactical EMS, or TEMS. Situations involving active threats, like SWAT calls or active shooters. How does the role of regular EMS change there?
It changes completely. If you're a non-tactical EMS unit responding to a scene like that, your priority shifts from immediate patient access to extreme self-preservation and support from a distance.
Meaning?
You don't just roll up to the front door with lights and sirens. Absolutely not. You turn off lights and sirens well before arriving. You stage in a designated safe area, usually directed by the law enforcement incident commander.
Staging area, okay.
You stay low, stay near your vehicle if you have to get out. You wait for instructions. Your job is essentially to be ready at that secure perimeter to receive patients after the tactical team has neutralized the threat and brought the injured to you.
So you're waiting for them to be evacuated from the hot zone by law enforcement.
Exactly. You do not enter the unsecured hot zone. You prepare to treat casualties once they're brought to the cold zone, often under police protection even then. It's a very different, very high-stress kind of waiting game. Okay, so fast forward through the technical part, whether it's cutting a car apart, pulling someone from a trench, or receiving them from a tactical team. As the patient is finally freed or being freed, that medical care ramps up again.
What are the priorities right then?
Control any immediate life threats that haven't been fully managed. Severe bleeding first, always. Dress wounds. Stabilize any obvious fractures. And continue to protect the spine if that's suspected.
Yeah.
Basically get them as stable as possible for the move.
Now, that whole process, especially in complex extrications, can take hours, as we've said. This puts patients at risk for a really nasty condition tied directly to being crushed or compressed for a long time. Compartment syndrome.
Yes, this is a really critical thing for responders to anticipate in these long rescues. Compartment syndrome happens, typically in limbs, when swelling occurs inside a muscle compartment, which is wrapped in tough connective tissue called fascia that doesn't stretch much.
Like a tight container.
Exactly. So if the muscle inside swells due to crush injury or lack of blood flow returning, the pressure inside that tight container skyrockets.
And cuts off blood flow.
Precisely. The pressure gets so high, it squeezes the blood vessel shut. No blood flow means no oxygen to the muscles and nerves in that compartment. If it lasts for, say, 4 to 6 hours or more, the tissue starts to die. It's incredibly painful and can lead to permanent damage or even amputation if not treated surgically quickly, usually by cutting the fascia open, a fasciotomy.
So the clock is always ticking, even when you have to move slowly for the rescue itself.
Always. It's one of the central tensions of this kind of work.
While all this is going on, pain management is happening too. You mentioned the calming talk earlier, but what else can be done in the field?
A lot focuses on non-drug methods initially. Simple things like careful, gentle handling make a huge difference. Splinting fractures properly, even before they're fully out, helps immensely by reducing movement at the injury site. Patting sharp edges or pressure points. These basic comfort measures actually reduce pain signals.
Okay, so they're finally free, stabilized as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Now comes packaging. What does that involve?
Packaging just means preparing the patient to be moved as a single secure unit, especially if they need to be lifted or carried over rough terrain. Often this involves a basket stretcher.
Like a Stokes basket.
Yeah, could be a wire Stokes basket or a plastic or fiberglass one. Provides good protection. They'll be secured inside that, often on a backboard first.
Are there special tools for specific injuries during packaging?
Definitely. If you suspect a pelvic fracture, for example, which is common in major trauma and can cause massive internal bleeding, you want to avoid flexing the pelvis. So they might be secured in a full body vacuum mattress.
Like a beanbag that goes rigid.
Exactly. It molds perfectly to the patient's body and then becomes rigid, providing excellent stabilization. For spinal injuries, we already mentioned immobilizing in the water, but for moving them out of a car, a device called a KED Kendrick extrication device is often used.
What's that?
It's like a semi-rigid vest that wraps around the torso and head, stabilizing the spine for removal from a seated position. Sometimes it's used with a S-Kate stretcher, which is a flexible plastic sheet that can wrap around the patient tightly. The key is keeping everything aligned during the move.
Okay, packaged and ready. The final step is the transport decision. How's that made?
It really comes down to two main things. How badly injured is the patient? Do they need a specialized trauma center? And second, how far away is the appropriate hospital? Sometimes the closest hospital isn't the best one for their injuries. It might involve a longer transport, maybe even calling for a helicopter.
So putting it all together, this whole deep dive, it really paints a picture of incredibly calculated risk management, a systematic process layered over what looks like pure chaos.
It really is. Every step we talked about, from preparation and size up through stabilization, hazard control, access, disentanglement, packaging, it's all about imposing control and safety onto an inherently dangerous situation. It follows that golden rule. We talked about safety first, then methodical work.
What really strikes me listening to all this is that constant tension you mentioned, the desperate need for speed because of the patient's injuries, like that risk of compartment syndrome setting in.
Right. Time is tissue.
Juxtaposed with the absolute necessity for slow, careful, methodical, technical work to get them out safely without causing more harm or getting rescuers hurt.
It's the core challenge, balancing urgency with safety and precision.
So here's something to think about for you listening. We know rapid transport is usually the goal in EMS. Get the critical patient to the hospital ASAP. But these technical rescues, by definition, often take hours. They involve massive resources, multiple agencies, complex tools, and that deliberate, sometimes painstaking slowness. How does that fundamentally change the equation for the patient's outcome, especially with conditions like compartment syndrome ticking away? What is the necessity of this extreme patience right in the middle of utter chaos? Tell us about the nature of emergency response.